Rock came to his senses in the main glower dome. He sat up and was handed a cup of ordinary tea, which he sipped slowly.
What did you experience, Roxon?
Pruzak and I had, sex. Mentally.
Yes, good. All have to be joined to Pruzak in order to dream. Now you have part of the help you need.
Did anyone hear what Turquoise said? He was about to tell me something critically important when
he... The linking, Roxon. The orgasm is what he said to you. Now, you can dream of him when it is necessary. Contact is assured. Your unconscious mind has registered him. The connection to the land of the dead is complete in you, Roxon. Death and orgasm. Death and orgasm. It is good.
Damn.
Now come. We have arranged for your new space vehicle. We have something better than your pathetic rocket to fly you to Karak.
Well, that's more like it.
Rock went with Romaru across a barren plain and behind a spike of red sandstone glowing in the moonlight. Was this a dream? Was Pruzak a dream? Had she made love to him by touching him? Was the interdimensional female real? What did the ritual and liqueur do to him? Anything? He felt his forehead. Romaru stopped Roxon before a blank sandstone wall. Slowly, the wall opened.
Come, see your new spacecraft.
They entered the dark square hole in the rocks. There was some sort of cocoon-like object in the vast open interior of the cliff. Roxon supposed that it was a cover on the spacecraft. The cocoon was lit with an inner light of bluish hue, and he could see the shadows of moving figures inside. He saw the outline of some sort of scaffolding around the shadow of a dirigible-shaped object.
Come.
They went to an area of the cocoon that seemed to have a shutter-like door, more like the lens of a camera than a door, actually. The door opened, and Roxon followed Romaru onto a ramp leading to the spacecraft. Roxon glanced at the ship's contours just before he entered. He hardly believed what he saw. This was no rocket. It was, instead, something from the imagination, the most peculiar spacecraft he'd ever seen.
What do you think?
It's shaped like a saucer.
Yes. The best design to use the Labar magnetic field flux drive we have installed. It will get you and your men to the asteroid and back. However, the controls are quite different than what you are accustomed to. I will have to fly it for you. But you do not just ride along. I only fly it until you can be trained adequately in the method. Now, Roxon, we take off. Sit down over there, the smaller contour couch. We must go.
Without my men?
No. You will tell your men on your little broadcast watch that we are going to pick them up at the same coordinates that you waited for my sand ship. Tell them to be there as quickly as they can ride.
20 minutes later, after a thorough inspection of the internal mechanisms of the glower spacecraft, Roxon sat next to Romaru as a hidden mountain door opened on silent hinges. The saucer was glowing blue as Romaru turned up the power, and the very air hummed. Through a visiscreen, Rock could see the glower ground crew step back. Then, there was a slight tilting of the floor. To maneuver the saucer, Romaru moved his hands in a glove-like control device. Rock found they were lifting up off the ground and moving out of the hangar into the cool night.
You will see through the visiscreen that we are moving about 10 feet off the ground. Hear the hum? That is the interaction of the Labar field drive I told you about with the Earth's gravity. The power we generate is to shield the Earth's gravity from the ship. It is important never to fly this craft upside down, for it would drop like a stone out of control. I will explain more as we fly.
Effortlessly, the saucer shot up into the starry black sky. The Rock team rode hell-bent for leather over the ridge and reached the coordinates where they were to meet the glower spacecraft. The sky was gray with pre-dawn light in the west, though plenty of stars were still out. The air was intensely cold, and the Brids exhaled clouds of hot mist as they rushed through the darkness. The chariot horses were groaning with strain to keep the nuke-loaded chariot up to speed.
Hey, one of the stars up there is moving!
I don't see anything! Just stars!
I do. I think it's a plane. It's definitely getting brighter and descending. Looks like it's coming this way.
The free fighters reached the top of the ridge. The sky object got closer and took form. Detroit's jaw dropped.
Holy smokes! It's not a plane at all! It's a fucking flying saucer! Rock's got us a flying saucer! Hey!
They all watched in awe as the softly glowing craft, which was the size of a baseball diamond, sat down on the ground on a tripod extension.
Holy mother!
Chen's wrist radio squawked to life.
Come on down and get in. We don't have much time to get to Karak. And wheel that nuke chariot down that hill gently.
When the men came riding up on their brids with the chariot rolling behind, Roxon was already outside the saucer craft, ready to greet them. He stood at the foot of a ramp leading up into the saucer, wearing a very iridescent blue jumpsuit. Rock's hair seemed to bellow out from his head as if electrified.
You look strange.
I've been through some strange shit. Get in. Come on.
The men hesitated.
Come on, come on. After we board, I'll put the nuke device on with an anti-gravity beam. Save your strength.
Rock, are you sure you're all right? Why were you out of contact for so long? Who's on board?
It's a long story. No time to go into it right now. I'm fine, and everything worked out, as you can see. The Glowers gave us this nifty spacecraft. Come on aboard. We've really got to go.
Somewhat reluctantly, they all boarded the saucer. The men settled down into the contour couches arrayed inside, behind Roxon and Romaru, who pushed some switches. The Glower didn't bother to introduce himself. Once they'd strapped in, Romaru started moving the thing up, using his hand inside the maneuver gloves. His suction cup-tipped hands were deft at their work. The ship started to float above the sands, and the tripod landing gear retracted. They all watched, amazed, through a viewport, as the big black box containing the bomb floated up into the side of the saucer, into a cargo hold.
Oh, shit. I never liked flying.
With a sudden waver, the saucer shot straight up, without any acceleration effect whatsoever. There were slight vibrations.
God! You can see the curvature of the Earth already! Rock, how come there's no feeling of moving, no noise? We should be pinned into these couches.
The couches, I'm told, are only a precaution for sudden so-called gusts in the magnetic winds of the universe. Don't ask me what we'd feel if there were a problem.
Roxon, take over.
Romaru slid his hand out of the maneuver gloves.
Hold on to your pants, guys. I'm flying now.
Rock traded seats with the Glower.
Hey, listen, fellas, I'm a little new at this. I only flew it around the Glower encampment before this. That's like learning to drive in a parking lot. Expect a few mistakes.
Romaru suggested maneuvers. Roxon tried his hands. Literally. His maneuvering ability was poor, and their course, as expressed on an inertial plotting graph on the wall above the visiport, filled with jagged lines. Still, the stars came out as Rock kept gaining altitude. A crescent moon appeared over the Earth. It shook. The saucer wobbled madly.
Oh, shit, pal! You can fly a chopper and a rocket, but you sure as hell don't have the hang of this yet, do you, Rock?
Shut up and let me concentrate!
Roxon continued his practice at the helm, under the tutelage of Romaru, for a half hour. The zigzag course left them all dizzy, but finally the maneuvers became smooth.
You're getting good, but I don't think you have the stabilizers figured out yet. I'll take over.
Rock took his hands from the steering gloves and relaxed as the Glower deftly brought them back on course toward the asteroid at altitude 14,000 miles. He brought them into a stationary orbit 20,000 miles from Earth and then set the autopilot.
Unstrap now, but remember to keep at least 1 foot on the floor. The artificial gravity works only when contact between your feet and the deck is maintained.
What's up?
Bad news. Prepare for evasive maneuvers. We're being attacked. 12 unidentified objects approaching at great velocity. Hold on. We're going to go between the biggest ones if possible. We might be hit by...
They all listened, cringing for another impact.
Very close call. It was pure accident that we're not...
Automatic sealers tried to close off the hole that had been punched in the outer hull. A white, pasty gunk oozed from the flooring around the 6-inch irregular hole. It wasn't working. Archer, whose couch was mere inches from the impact hole, sprang into action. He ripped his big, smelly bearskin vest off and jammed it into the gap.
Good work, Arch. Safe now. Air is stable. I regret the loss of an article of clothing.
God, what hit us? It went right to the floor, but I don't see an exit hole. Where is it?
The thing must have bounced off the ceiling, but I don't know where it is now. Look around and watch out. It might be hot.
Everyone started examining the floor, under the couches, along the walls. No foreign object.
What kind of thing was it? It's too jagged a dent for a shell, I think. Maybe it was a meteor.
No, not a meteor. It was not missiles that attacked us, just space debris left over from the experiments of the 20th century. Debris from old satellites breaking up. There are millions of chunks of debris out here. This saucer is capable of avoiding all but the smallest ones. We can't detect those even on the finest of our instruments. Our combined speed was 40 kilometers per second. We're lucky only one of us got hit.
What do you mean? Who got hit, Romaro?
We are moving into high orbit, Roxon. Please take over the controls. I can't.
Rock saw the glower sag on his webbed feet. Romaro was the one who'd been hit. Rock went instinctively to grab hold of him.
No!
Rock saw that green-blue liquid, slightly phosphorescent, was leaking from Romaru's central torso.
As fate would have it, you will have to fly this craft from now on. Good luck, friend. I will die now. It is good to join the universe beings.
Then there was a brilliant white flash, and then... no more Romaru. An object fell to the floor. It was a rusted, oblong piece of steel about 6 inches wide. The piece of space shrapnel that had struck Romaru. Aside from the steel object, all that was left was dust. Dust collapsing to the floor, being blown around. It shimmered.
Like pixie dust. Is that how glowers die? They just disappear?
Who knows?
Do you think you'll be able to fly this thing to Karak?
I think I can handle it. There's a lot of automatic control equipment built in. I've made big mistakes before, and the saucer self-corrected. The glowers even installed that little monitor screen on your right. It prints out in English suggestions for correcting mistakes the pilot makes. I'm gonna need that. Keep your eyes on it.
Rock slipped into the steering gloves, began correcting course, intending to rise again to the vector that would intersect the asteroid. But nothing happened.
The readout says, main engine Labar drive shut down due to serious mechanical damage. Oh.
Can we fix it?
If the robotics of this saucer can't fix it, we sure as hell can't.
Rock quickly read some of the velocity and air pressure numbers.
We have 30 hours of oxygen. We'll fall back to Earth in 26 hours and 10 minutes. We will burn up and crash before we suffocate, unless we can restart the Labar drive. That's it. It doesn't look good, sorry guys. I'm telling it like it is.
It's odd. I feel so safe. It's so quiet and comfortable in here.
Well, it must be a mistake. We can't die now. We've come so close to...
Shut up, Harper! Surely something can be done, Rock. Shouldn't we look around under the hatches or something? Try to repair the saucer?
Shit, I don't even know if there are ways to get to the Labar drive or what the engine runs on. Romaro said it was a magnetic gravity flux. I don't even know what that is.
The engine looks to be all in one piece.
Sharansky crawled up out of the floor hatch and was shaking his head back and forth. With heroic effort, the Rock team and the four young technical men had managed to unseal a dozen access hatches on the craft in the past 2 hours as the saucer inexorably slowed and began to plummet back to Earth. They had explored the mysterious, totally alien machinery below deck without finding a thing they understood, let alone fix.
All of you, come back up here. Let's try another approach. And everyone... see if you can find some sort of technical manuals before you try to monkey with that stuff down there.
They searched all over the main deck, found several drawers, one of which had a very, very ancient Drya's parchment technical manual in English. Rock handled it gingerly. The 1,000-page manual, written in the 1980s by a James and John Labar of Mount Kisco, New York, was the patent application for the Labar anti-gravity drive.
Oh, God. Romaro told me that the propulsion system of the saucer was an old design, one rejected as incomprehensible by the United States Patent Office, just like some of Robert Goddard's early rocket patents were. The Labar brothers based their design for the engine upon the location matrices of the so-called Ogham Rocks, scattered all over the Northern Hemisphere, particularly in Westchester County, New York. The brothers believe that the ancient Celts had access to the same sources of vast magneto-electrical power that the Incas had used to build their walled cities, namely the inherent energy of the Earth's own core field. They plotted the locations of the ancient grid marking rocks, some of which were on their 100-acre estate, and translated many rock inscriptions. They didn't claim to understand them all, but they learned how to make a series of gravity baffle levers, sort of Venetian blinds that block off gravity instead of light. And it worked.
So can we fix the Labar drive using that manual as a guide?
Not a chance we can fix the drive engine. We need James and John here to explain some of their notes.
Oh, I have idea.
Okay, shoot.
Simple, get help.
Thanks a lot, Archer. Where?
At Frenchie Space Station.
What's he raving about?
Roxon quickly recapped, for the men who hadn't been along on that particular adventure, that he'd once visited an old space station inhabited by Frenchmen.
Archer's idea is a wild one, but a good one. Help me work the rangefinders. If we can get to the closest of the old space stations like Archer here wants, there may be parts or something like an old shuttlecraft to use. We have a little bit of stabilizer power, not enough to land on Karak or even get back to Earth. But Archer is right. There are a few old space stations up here.
They worked the Visiscreen telescopic search model until they found a large object in orbit. It was just 1,230 kilometers higher.
Within range.
Roxon zeroed in on the maximum power of the telescope right on the object.
There. That's it. I've located the Frenchie Junk space station. It is just coming over Earth horizon. Wow. Looks like someone built a new flying Eiffel Tower design. I was sure the one I visited a few years ago was destroyed.
There's no lights and no radio signals.
There's no signs of life. Maybe if we get closer, we'll see something. No other options anyway.
Rock looked over to Detroit, who was monitoring the stabilizer's fuel situation.
How are we for gas?
Not enough to get us there. I'm sorry.
We can't make it. It was all for nothing. So close and no hope.
They all sat around, dejected, watching the Earth grow slowly closer.
If only the Frenchies could reach us.
Rock got on the radio, tried again for contact. No answer. A look through the scope still showed no lights.
We'll die in about 16 hours before the asteroid hits Earth. There's not much difference. Nice try anyways, guys. The Earth has to end sometime, and I guess it's fate.
Everyone hoped Roxon had some solution. He did. Roxon lay down on a couch and closed his eyes. He fell asleep immediately. They all had gone without sleep for many hours, but the others were too tense to sleep.
Well, might as well catch a few winks. Maybe with some rest we can think of something.
The air must be getting stuffy.
So, you're not asleep, Rock. The air's fine. Why do you say that it isn't?
Because I'm hallucinating. When I close my eyes, I think I see the turquoise ghost right over there.
I see him too, Rock! Transparent! Glowing!
I am the turquoise ghost. Roxon dreams of me, so I am here. I've come to help you. There is a way to get to the space station if you, Roxon, have obeyed me. If you obeyed me.
A slow rising of the ghost's ectoplasmic blue arm followed, then the faint voice from beyond.
Do you have my gift with you?
What gift? Oh, the aluminum foil and the wire coat hangers. Yes, I do.
Then sail. Use the gifts to sail to the space station. Sail on the cosmic winds. Sail on sunlight.
The ghostly image faded away.
What's he mean?
He said sail. Listen, Chen, there's no friction out here in space, is there?
Right.
Then all of you help me suit up. I'm going out on the saucer's hull and make a sail. A sail to catch the solar wind. I'll make it out of the aluminum foil and the wire coat hangers I've carried for no apparent good reason since Turquoise gave them to me. They're in my backpack. Even that kind of sail might give enough of an extra boost to move the saucer out to the Frenchy space station.
There were several spacesuits in the storage area, but they had been, of course, made for glowers to wear. Roxanne got inside one easily, for it was nearly twice as big as what he needed. Then Chen screwed the helmet globe in place and increased the airflow inside with the valve until it was up to the capacity needed for a human. Roxanne couldn't figure out how to use the suit's intercom, so he just gestured for the men to help him into the narrow airlock and to operate the hatchway into outer space. And then, all Rock could see was a black canvas painted with millions of stars. They looked so close. He walked gingerly out into space on his magnetic boots along the saucer's hull and erected a makeshift sail from the wire coat hangers in the foil. Before he went back inside, he saw the foil stiffen in the solar light wind. An hour later, the Free Fighter team sat around inside the saucer and watched the speed indicators creep up, a few more kilometers an hour at best, but they'd be able to get to the space station.
3 more hours and we'll be there.
But what will we find there? It looks deserted.
It's our only chance, Cohen. Thanks to my ghost friend, and of course Archer, who had the idea in the first place.
As they got closer to the space station, things didn't look at all promising. The closer Rock maneuvered the creeping saucer, the more dead the place seemed. Lifeless. A ruin. The whole space Eiffel Tower seemed blackened and pitted. There was a trace of radioactivity on the metal surfaces, according to the readouts. No signs of life.
Must have been some hell of a solar flare a while back. Probably that's what did this damage and cremated them all. Poor bastards.
What now, Rock?
Well, we can at least go aboard and check it out. Maybe we can procure some of their oxygen tanks. They won't need them anymore. Search for some fuel cells or rocket engines.
Look at all those parts of conventional fueled rocket engines floating off to the side. There's some really big debris around here. And look! Further over there! It's a goddamn space cruiser! With Nazi insignia on it. Pitted and blackened. Ancient 20th century style. Junk.
What a junkyard. But junkyards can be useful. We can maybe weld together some sort of engine, something to transport us to the asteroid. It's possible, I think. Karak has an atmosphere. We can parachute down with the bomb on another parachute or two. We just have to get to Karak, somehow.
Are you sure you're feeling okay, Rock?
Look, I know it's a long shot, but what the hell do we have to lose? Let's go see.
So they all put on the oversized spacesuits of the missing glower crew and went to the airlock. One by one, they took the big jump into nothingness. This time, Roxanne got the suit intercom functioning.
Shiransky, there's no gravity up here. You can't fall, so don't worry. Use the little gas jet unit under your suit to maneuver. It's only 50 yards over to that open hatch door on the Frenchy space station.
Shiransky made it, then several others. No sweat.
Light as feather!
They all floated over to the open section of the hulking gridwork of the Eiffel-style space station. Roxanne's metal-grabbing boots clanked across the metal deck. Roxanne went over to the door.
Come on, Space Rangers. We're on a roll.
Their boots clanked and echoed as they walked down the cold, dark space corridor. Once they were all inside the rusted metal corridor, Rock smashed his fist on the Fermé button behind the entrance door.
No one take your suits off just yet. Not until we find out what's up.
Roxanne walked onward until his flash beam hit a horrible sight that made him gasp. Wide-eyed, half-skeletal corpses lying amid battle debris.
Oh, God. Look at the burn holes in them. Must have been quite a fight here.
Detroit bent slowly in his ungainly spacesuit to examine a body.
This one died by violence for sure. Bullet holes, Swell. But the readings indicate the air is okay, at least. So take off your helmets and save the air in your suits for the return trip to the saucer.
Reluctantly, everyone took off their helmets and tried the atmosphere. It smelled dank, but otherwise seemed okay.
What happened here?
Must have been a boarding of the space station by someone who wanted trouble.
Who would do this?
There, look at that guy. He's got a Nazi uniform on. My guess is that it was an attack by a band of space Nazis. I ran into them before, but the Frenchies must have put up quite a fight. Probably they all wiped each other out. It's a shame.
Me like those Frenchies.
Yeah, me too. Maybe we should say a prayer for them and give them a decent burial in space. Look around, see if you can find any oxygen tanks as you gather the bodies.
The reports of the death of Les Frenchies, monsieur? Or, how you say, greatly exaggerated?
The free fighters spun around to see a man standing behind them, holding a ray gun. He stepped from behind cover of a pillar steel. The man had penetrating blue eyes and a bearded face.
How you men arrive ici, eh? How you get here? Comprenez?
Yes, I understand. We came in that saucer out there. We come as friends. Ami, comprenez? Please step into the light. Let us see your face.
The man with a gun stayed in the shadows.
Oh, you missed a grand battle. You see, we have had le difficult to comprend, but it is all over now. Come, Malaisie, and enjoy.
The man came into the light.
Louis, is it you, mon ami?
Rock and Louis walked along with the others trailing behind.
So, what is it that bring les Americans back into l'orbit? No, Areste, let me suggest. Is it the Doom asteroid? Is it that she come to destroy us all? You come to have a last grand soiree, a party with us before we all die. That, mon ami, c'est bon.
No, we come to stop the asteroid.
That is not possible. The magnetic field around it would deflect on the missile. C'est vrai, mon cher ami. You come here in false hopes, but do not be sad. We die having a big party, eh? Lots of women and le champagne. A nice way to leave the universe, you think not, Roxanne? Celebrate avec les Astro-Franchis.
Listen, Louis. You see what we're flying? It's a great ship. It's damaged, but that saucer has a special kind of mechanism to counter the magnetic force of Karak. That's the name of the Doom asteroid. If you and your men can help us fix our saucer, we can deliver a bomb to Karak and...
Roxanne continued to explain as they all entered a larger chamber in the space station. This huge, dimly lit room was filled with floating men and women. The women were in hoop skirts, the men in frock jackets and silk tights. The smell of roast pork and filet de foie gras, plus haricot vert, was powerful and appealing.
Ah, Roxanne, I am glad to hear you wish to try to save the Earth. This is bon. I will make announcement of your plan. But first, we will eat our feast. And then we go fix up your strange ship.
Maybe we should just skip the banquet.
No, no, mon ami. Never, never skip the repast. C'est vrai, mon cher ami. A man does not work well on the empty stomach. There will be much reconstruction work, I think, on your saucer. So we must eat well to do it well.
Well, all right.
The soiree began. The Frenchies cheered the Americans and the news that there was chance to save Earth. Louis introduced Roxham and his men to several bigwigs of the space station, namely Claude the Mad, Jacques, and Alexis. Then the Americans were all served slices of well-fatted roast pork and haricot vert. Roxham preferred his meat lean, but lit into the pork. After a while at the party, Louis motioned for Rock to follow him. Louis led the pair to a smaller conference room. There was a little gravity here. Rock saw several metal-bedecked officials sitting around a large table.
What's this about, Louis?
This place, don't you know, is the main trading chamber. We must talk.
The Frenchie got down to business quickly. The business of fitting Roxanne's saucer with the equipment necessary to reach Karak and save the Earth. Roxanne was amazed that the Frenchie leader was demanding payment for the rocket boosters they would provide him. Roxon immediately proposed that perhaps Louis didn't really understand the gravity of the situation.
To negotiate is ridiculous. This isn't business. The Earth is in danger. If the Earth is destroyed, nothing of this space station will survive.
Yes, but that is just the point. We Frenchies have every confidence that you will save the Earth. And since everything will be normal, it will again be important that we, how you say, get a bon marche, a good trade with the American.
Oh, damn French.
The Frenchy chieftain was a hard bargainer. He agreed to exchange most of Rock's food supply, the food Rock had intended for eating on Karak, for a quick and expert repair job on the saucer. They were not going to try to repair the impossible-to-comprehend Labar drive, but decided instead to refit the saucer with conventional rocket boosters. Later, Rock showed the agreement he signed to Detroit.
They sure got everything but our nightshirts in the deal, Rock. How could you sign this?
Listen, Detroit, I had to agree to the deal. We're late for our date with the god of fear, Karak.
2 hours and 20 minutes later, Rock was floating in his spacesuit outside the space station. He used his jets and floated up alongside Chen.
The repairs look good. I'm glad it's the Frenchies, not us, floating around and welding all that stuff on the saucer. It's hard enough to hold my cookies not knowing which way is up. Work would be too much.
Archer sure looks happy, though. He's manhandling huge parts for them. Soon the saucer will have all the power it needs. It's what McCoughlin calls a Brumund miracle.
And we can do what we came up here to do.
Roxon was sure glad that the Frenchies had traded all the Free Fighters' ungainly glower spacesuits for some of the space station's regular old model suits. They probably got some advanced features on the glower equipment, but Rock preferred his man-sized outfit. The arms and legs of the Frenchie spacesuits were more flexible also. He looked around at the stars, at the Earth.
To be up here, floating in space, watching a bunch of French exiles weld boosters onto our flying saucer.
I never dreamed this could happen.
Chen went to help move an engine up to the saucer with a gang of Frenchies, leaving Rock floating 30 yards from the craft, watching in amazement with some tension.
Much fun! Me like space, work easy, feel like fly.
Glad you're enjoying it.
Work took another hour. The Frenchies were just finishing the installation of the last rocket engine attachment, making it look kind of like a weird giant ceiling fixture.
Sacre bleu, Rock! Allez ici!
Huh? Can you speak English? S'il vous plaît? What's the matter? Qui fait?
Roxon saw Louis' distinctive tiger-striped spacesuit jetting toward him.
What's the matter?
Roxon, there is another rocket craft taking off from the Earth. You come look through the ground telescope, mon ami.
Roxon jetted back to the big broken Eiffel Tower space station with Louis. Without taking off their spacesuits, this part of the half-wrecked station had no air pressure yet. They went directly to the observatory room. There, Rock was directed to a long refractor telescope, constructed of a design and ornamentation that would make Jules Verne cream in his pants. Rock pressed his eye as close to the eyepiece as possible and saw a view not of the stars, but of an area of South America. The mountain range he perceived was partly veiled by clouds.
See?
Rock saw. There were twin red-white flames outlined against the peaks of the Andes of Peru.
Do you not see? It is for sure a spacecraft. It is Kilov's rocket ship. It is evident Kilov has left Peru. According to the speed at which he approaches us, he will soon go right past us and head for Karak.
Rock had to adjust the high-powered focus several times to keep the rocket image clearly in view. It was going very fast, escape velocity or better. He saw the rocket's first stage boosters suddenly flare out, and then the boosters fell away. The rocket's main engine erupted into flames. Damn, why couldn't it have failed? Then the bastard would have fallen back to Earth.
But no such luck.
Then Roxon saw something about the rocket that he particularly didn't like to see. There were barbs on the craft, barbs of jetting objects, nasty-looking appendages that could only be guns or missiles. The Frenchy leader was busy at a control panel. He confirmed to Roxon that the equipment said the approaching rocket did have weapons, missiles, and more.
Oh, sorry, Roxon. We Frenchies can't arm you with anything like that. We have just a few cannons.
When will he get here?
In a few hours at most.
We will be done fixing your saucer, don't worry. You will leave ahead of him.
But Kilov has real power in that thing. He'll catch up to us. Can you think of anything to counter his missile capability so we don't get shot down?
Nothing to match that stuff. Because all of our missiles, she was used up in our war with the Nazis. Or rather, the remnants of the Femo Nazis. But we can give you a large swivel gun, you know, an anti-aircraft gun? And also perhaps some extra maneuver power. We can give you some more booster jets. Perhaps enough so that you get out of the way if Kilo fires at you, okay? It will only take a few extra minutes to strap on the maxi boosters, provided...
Louis smiled through his visiplate.
Yeah, I know, provided we can make a deal. What do you want?
Roxanne quickly agreed to trade their Frenchie spacesuits back once the Americans had boarded the saucer again. In return, the Frenchies would provide the maxi boosters Louis had spoken about. The rocket they suspected of being Kilov's was less than 40 minutes away by the time the Frenchies finished strapping high-speed maneuver jets to the saucer. Roxanne rushed up in the newly created gunnery bubble at the apex of the saucer. There, he saw McCaughlin supervising the bolting down of the huge, twin-barrel anti-spacecraft attack gun. McCaughlin would man it, for he had experience with such primitive artillery. He had once led an artillery barrage that had been outfitted from a 20th century army depot.
Wow, an illuminated crosshair and a built-in laser tracking mechanism. This is a great toy, better than the weapon I had back
when. Glad you like it, but remember, this toy might be the only thing that'll keep us alive if Kilov gets on our tail.
Rock called out to Louis on the wrist radio.
Louis, how soon until you finish checking out the wiring?
10 minutes, mon cher. I will have your saucer out of here in 10 minutes. You will have a bomb head start on Kilov. The extra booster jet should keep you ahead of him all the way to Karak. At least, most of the way.
That's what worries me, Scott. Those words, most of the way. All Kilov has to do is get within range of us, and he can send out a gaggle of his intercept missiles against us.
Just let him get in range of this twin-barrel death dealer, Rock, and I'll show the crumb bum what it's like to have his face smeared all over outer space.
Careful, Scott. There's no safety on that thing. You don't want to blast our host space station to pieces, do you?
No, I guess not.
Rock made his way back to the cockpit. Detroit was co-piloting, and the Black Free Fighter was already seated, checking system activation lights. There was a whole mess of new ones, installed to monitor and fire the extra rocket boosters. Chen was at the science officer's desk console, flicking a bevy of new switches there. He hadn't given up on reading the old manual. He was still attempting to restore at least partial power to the Labar anti-gravity drive. If they could get even a small percent of that power, they'd have a better chance of evading Kilov.
How's the Labar? Looks like you got something going there with all those levers.
I have a few percent of the power we had coming up here, Rock. But it won't last 15 seconds. I strongly suggest that we use the Labar power I have to move the saucer away from the space station before we ignite that mess of strapped-on rocket boosters.
Good idea. Do it.
Everyone strapped down? Here goes.
The saucer started moving without rocket power. It edged a few feet per minute away from the waving Frenchies floating about in space until it was a half mile or more from the station.
Bon voyage, mon ami. Bon voyage et bonne chance. American, we depend on you.
That's all from here, Rock. It's your turn.
Here goes nothing.
Don't worry, guys. We can count on our maneuvering jets. Plus McCaughlin's twin attack guns when Kilov gets near.
The saucer unsteadily but rapidly shot away from the Earth-orbiting French space station. Soon, Roxanne was pleased to see the death asteroid looming in the forward visor screen. 5 minutes passed, then 10. The saucer held up, though it shook like jello.
Main boosters shut down.
The acceleration quickly died down to Earth-normal gravity.
Shit. Kilov has already passed the space station. He spotted us, and he's gaining on us. He's opening his missile ports, ready to fire.
Does Kilov know about the asteroid? Doesn't he realize he should leave us alone, that we're the only chance to save Earth? Why would he fire at us?
Kilov's motives are never clear, but he's comfortable with destruction. He loves destruction.
The radar approach indicator told the story. Kilov's ship was very fast, and soon high-frequency microwaves were washing over the saucer.
Kilov's instruments are scanning us. He's closing to within missile range. Chen, might as well try some of that Labar power again if you have it. Give us whatever juice you can. Just wait until I get seated. McCaughlin, can you hear me up in the dome? Did you hear all this?
Hear you clear, Rock. Don't you worry. I've got the guns pointed aft, and I will fire the minute Kilov's in range.
I don't really know exactly what they're doing, Rock, so hold on. Something is starting to happen.
The ship shuddered as they all strapped down tight, and acceleration built up again.
The boosters are only strapped on, Chen. Don't go too fast.
I can't control it. I suggest we all pray.
The acceleration went on for 20 or 30 seconds.
That's all we got. The rest will have to be your game.
Shit! What's that buzzer sound? What's that mean?
It means that Kilov's ship has gotten within missile range of us, and he's firing his missiles right now!
In the gunnery bubble, Scott McCaughlin focused in the crosshairs on Kilov's spacecraft. He got a bead just as the evil KGB-er unleashed a pair of Skosk missiles from the underbelly of his bat-wing-shaped rocket craft.
Oh, will you look at that?
McCaughlin quickly moved the crosshairs away from Kilov's ship to keep up with the first of the destructive missiles.
You have to get that missile!
The crosshairs flashed bright red, stayed on the fast-moving Soviet missile.
All right, now where's that other bastard?
McCaughlin spun the gun, looking for the second missile. It was following some big piece of the first missile, away from the saucer.
Oh, I'm mucho glad that wasn't a noob tip job. Now, get Kilov, will you, Scott?
Damn you, Roxanne!
Kilov had expected to shout in elation, but the enemy had destroyed his missiles. Now he'd have to fire the cannons and the three mini-snark heat-seeking smart bombs, all at the same time.
On my command!
But sir, that would destabilize us!
Just do what I say before that wily Ruxin figures out some other clever damned maneuver on us!
Kilov and Tekamaki were the only two beings aboard the quickly built rocket. It was actually six rockets, six ICBMs made into one superior spacecraft using ancient Inca welding secrets. Kilov had tracked the American saucer right up from the western United States. He was certain that Roxanne was aboard, for he had intercepted some of the Doomsday Warriors' radio communications with the Space Frenchies. Kilov had eavesdropped on the conversations in which he'd been amazed to hear that the asteroid was going to hit the Earth. Amazed, but not displeased. He had begun to formulate a new plan, one that would make him and his faithful servant Tekamaki the last two people alive in the universe.
He who lives last wins the game. Didn't Nietzsche say that? Or was it Saddam? Never mind.
Tekamaki, who was a samurai by heredity and therefore an armaments expert, hit all the switches. 1,000 rounds of explosive cannonballs flung themselves out where Roxanne's saucer had been, and missed. The smart bombs were another matter, though.
Die, you mothers!
Aboard the saucer, McCaughlin was doing his best, but he'd hit only one smart bomb that honed in on the saucer. One out of 17. Roxanne's quick maneuvers had saved them so far.
I'm out of ammo, Rock! If you head 0900, you can maneuver out of the way of those things! They're in a cluster!
Negative! Booster shut down!
13 seconds to impact! 11! 10!
So this is it. Let me say it was great pleasure to serve with you, Commander. And I just want to...
I fixed the Labar drive! Hit the main drive thrusters, now!
Roxanne did, and the saucer shot out of the way of the oncoming smart bombs. Easy as pie.
My God, we have nearly full power. We can do anything. I can run rings around Kilov. Maybe we should go back and sail past Kilov and unleash a few shots of our own at him.
With what? Remember, I'm flat out of ammo.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Damn. Well, we'll just have to leave him.
No. You can do what you want to do. Listen, just go back and get that smart bomb group back on our tail. Keep them close, but not too close.
I get it. Hit him with his own smart bombs.
Rock expertly maneuvered to approach Kilov's lost armaments. He got them to spot the saucer, then led the smart bombs around full circle and closed on Kilov's batwing rock craft with deadly accuracy.
Just like a game of chicken, Kilov's gonna have to blink first.
Move!
Kilov did blink. The saucer flitted by them, mere yards away.
That was close.
Got him good!
Look, Kilov dead? Maybe we go back and see?
No time. Have to get to Korak and deflect it. Only 4 hours, 10 minutes till doomsday.
Roxen was satisfied at what he saw in the rear scope. A blasted open, smoking hull of torn metal, floating dead in space behind the saucer. No one could have survived that. Kilov awoke, floating, his right arm dangling broken behind his back. He couldn't move it. There was blood floating off from a hole in his face. He tried to suck in air and found there was none. Through blurred eyes, he looked around him and just saw stars. The rocket craft was still there, to his left. But to his right, there were gaping holes in the control compartment, and he could see the stars. He fumbled to grab a twisted pillar of steel with his good arm, headed his body toward the smoking wreck of the console controls. Not much remained of it. Nothing to use to gain control. He tried to yell, but there was no air to carry sound, except for the roaring of the boiling blood in his eardrums and trickle noise of blood floating out of his broken nose. All was silent. What to do? Was this the end? Kilov prayed to the Dark One to keep his trust, to let Kilov the Destroyer live. He frantically searched for something that could help him in the half-light of the smoldering plastic and metal. Then, his swelling, about to explode eyes, alighted on an intact door. There was a face in the porthole window. It was Tekamaki, gesturing violently, egging Kilov on. It was his faithful servant telling Kilov silently to try to make it closer to the door. There was air there. Air and a chance to live. Kilov pressed his feet against a twisted girder and took a leap. He flew most of the way over to the door, close enough for Tekamaki to open the door quickly. The pressure built up, and Kilov heaved in a breath or two of ice-cold oxygen.
Best I can do. That's all the pressure we have. Are you okay, Your Excellency?
For now, yes. What's the situation? Any control left?
We can divert what power we have, sir, to control it from this emergency capsule room. But the rocket's main engines are blown off. We are plummeting on toward Korak without any way to slow down. I'm afraid we'll break up in its atmosphere or in 10 or 12 minutes.
And Roxen saucer, is it?
It's still intact, I'm sorry to say. It's heading for Korak on a normal path. The Americans will land successfully there in a matter of minutes.
I'm not a quitter, Tekamaki. Show me what you have found in this room. Show me the divert controls. We'll survive. We will.
33 seconds before Kilov's blasted hulk of a rocket ship was to hit the atmosphere of the asteroid.
I have partial power on the steering rockets. Enough to fire them and slow us down a bit.
Tekamaki had never seen such a brilliant job of shunting, rewiring, and all-around improving that Kilov had made in the past minutes. But would it be enough? The angry oblate ball of death called Korak rushed at them more and more quickly by the second.
We're going to make it, aren't we, Magnificent Master?
Shut up and let me steer. We will survive.
The pink cratered ground approached at a steep angle.
I will this wreck to hold together. I'm heading for that desert area. I refuse to die. We will not break up. We will end and live. I will live to kill Roxanne.
Tekamaki sure hoped so, but judged by the speed at which the asteroid's tumbled terrain was approaching, and by the scream of the parts flying off the broken spacecraft as it entered the strange world's thin atmosphere, survival didn't seem very likely. Korak was a spectacular sight through the forward visiscreen of the saucer.
It looks like huge Idaho potato.
Yeah, a potato with dozens of craters spewing slow streams of ice particles and blue-white gas up from its pink skin.
Rock could see crisscrossing dark lines all over the oblate sphere.
Those aren't roads, just lines of stress or fissures. But it gives the place a roadmap sort of look, doesn't it?
There was a grayish mist moving rapidly above most of Korak. Perhaps that mist was an early sign of the thin atmosphere's disturbance caused by the asteroid's ever closer approach to the Earth, which hung like a huge blue and white beach ball in the sky.
Having a bit of trouble matching velocity with this babe. It's damn good to have all that Labar power. We never could have made it otherwise.
Roxon ejected the spent rocket boosters the Frenchies had added to the craft, then lowered the saucer to 10 miles altitude, circled Karak slowly, in a spiral, so all the surface could be visually and radar scanned. The idea was to circle the potato-shaped planetoid, searching for the geyser that was positioned to best deflect the asteroid.
We can plant a nuke bomb, take off again, and set it off. If the explosion opens up the geyser, the thing, according to Schechter's theory, can spew out more powerfully. The jet of gases will deflect the asteroid. At least that's the idea. It might work, it might not. But it's our only chance.
Rock made nearly one complete pass around Karak before he saw what he wanted.
There, see that large crater? That's a dormant geyser. Right at the south pole of this hunk of shit. Right at the side that never points toward Earth. That's where we deposit our nuke bomb.
But aren't we trying to nudge the damned asteroid sideways? Why do you want to blast it at its far end? That would just speed it on its way toward Earth, only make things worse.
Not really. If we can speed up the asteroid, it will pass through the Earth's orbit before Earth gets into position to be destroyed. It's actually the most efficient use of the nuke bomb. It will take advantage of the natural impetus of this little world. Hang on to something. We're going down there. And remember, it might be rough. I never landed this thing before.
Roxon deftly set the saucer down on the asteroid surface. Then an automatic sequence began that cut power and slid a ramp down to the surface.
We don't need spacesuits. We don't have any anyway. But the air is okay. We know that from the instrument's readouts. So let's go.
The free fighters bounded out into the chilly south pole air of the asteroid, just 70 or 80 yards from the puffing geyser crater that Roxon had picked for the exploding. In a short while, the nuke was manhandled over the rim of the crater wall and put in place. Then Rock and his men rushed back toward the saucer. It was a miracle they were alive. But more than that, Karak's atmosphere seemed to have an inebriatingly high amount of oxygen, plus some trace amounts of nitrous oxide, laughing gas. It caused all the men's heads to spin. Suddenly, it was all too much for Roxon. He fell behind his men, sat down on a blasted pink stone. His head spun like he was on a merry-go-round. And there came a vision. Rock suddenly saw, in place of blasted mountainsides and deep fissures of the dead world, a city of gleaming jeweled spires and a network of fantastic three-level highways passing through it, a highway streaming with sleek silver vehicles. In place of the geyser blowhole, he saw a dome of power, a geothermic power station with high-tension wires leading from it. The heat of the planetoid's interior was tapped for all its power. Clean, free power. This was a wonderful world full of life, a vast high-tech civilization. And Rock saw tall, extremely noble-looking men and women, the ancient, wise Karakans moving about him, even through him, like he was a ghost. Roxon knew these things couldn't be. He'd circled the whole surface of this dead world. What was he seeing? Rock shook his head violently, trying to throw off the fuzzy feeling, to get his eyes and mind back in order. Still, the vision stayed. One of the bluish-faced Karakans stopped.
You will see as we were, stranger. Now, seek the Pyramid of the Neurodancer. It is 12 of your miles northwest. Set off your primitive explosive device, then go there and meet destiny. Remember, be pure.
Rock quickly got up and ran back to his spacecraft. Rock took off steeply, and then, when his craft was miles above the pink spitball of a world, he pressed the detonation button to set off the nuke they had left behind on the surface. There was a brilliant white flash, and when it died down, a new and mighty geyser was pouring from the planetoid.
We did it! We did it!
Archer was right. In a few more minutes, Roxon's instruments confirmed that the asteroid was increasing in velocity. It would miss Earth.
I'll go home and eat big steak.
Yeah, sure, but first we check out the pyramid.
Rock! What's the matter, Rock? There was no pyramid.
No. Before we got onto the ship, I had a vision. I believe I saw a vision of this asteroid's past. A vision of the glory days of Karak, when it was inhabited. I saw a man just before my vision faded. He told me to go to a pyramid. He gave me directions. He implanted in my mind the pyramid's image. But, yes, I remember that strange-shaped mountain that was partly covered by ice clouds that we passed just a few minutes before we set down. That was the pyramid.
Roxon, to everyone's chagrin, delayed setting out for their home world and circled Karak again. He was frantically skimming the surface, looking for God knows what.
That's the pyramid, the one I saw in my vision, only all tumbled down.
Rock, you're wrong. There's nothing down there except an old fallen down hill. It looks a bit like a pyramid, I'll grant you, but it isn't. Maybe you got too much of the Karak oxygen-rich air.
No, it makes sense if you think of it. The ancient inhabitants of Karak would have some way of leaving a message for us. I saw their civilizations. It was magnificent. They used the thermal power of this world to maneuver it anywhere they wanted to go. They sent this tiny world wherever they wanted. The whole damn asteroid is a natural spaceship. We have time now to explore. If we could see what they have in that pyramid, he, the Karakan ghost, called it the Neurodancer.
But wouldn't it have all been destroyed by time and the elements by now?
No. Their sort of machines, that kind of exquisite mechanism, would still be working automatically. Think about their great science. The asteroid would have passed by the Earth if mankind hadn't screwed up Earth's orbit with the explosions of all those nukes in World War III 100-plus years ago. Then Karak would have been only affected by Earth's gravity and swung by like a slingshot back to the outer solar system.
Rock landed again. The ramp went down, and they reluctantly followed him out. Clouds of pink-gray mists rose from a cratered surface.
There's the pyramid. Look at its lines. That mountain is an old pyramid. It's 10 times the size of the Cheops in Egypt. There's a face carved right on it. A human face. The Karakans were like those ancient long-headed Inca gods you can see in those wall motifs in South America. I want to go in, get in somehow, take a look at what's there. We have to find a door.
You're counting a lot on what you saw in your vision, Rock. It still looks like a pile of rocks to me. Like the ones in your head.
Never mind what it looks like. Come on and help me find the door.
Nearly everyone unencumbered himself of his heavy weapons to begin feeling around on the slanted wall of rocks for the door their commander believed was there. It stirred and awakened. Something was near. Something alive. Something that was necessary. It had slept there, in the sands by the Pyramid of Mu, for thousands of years, ever since the old ones had died, ever since the water had run out. It needed water to exist, and when there was no more water, it slowed down. It did not die. It hibernated through the long, long centuries, waiting for some water. And now, it sensed that water. An antenna uncurled from its head, went up through the sand, came out into the dry, cool air. Yes, the dowser antenna bent towards some movement mere yards away. There were odd, two-legged creatures there. Creatures whose bodies were made almost entirely of water. Water enough to quench its centuries of need, enough to restore it and let it live again. Slowly, the 100-foot-long slug caterpillar shifted the enveloping sand around it. It struggled to push its blunt, many-eyed spout up and out into the Karakan air. When its head did emerge, its many eyes were nearly blinded by the sun. They were hard to focus, but its 6 noses smelled the creatures all right. The 2-legged ones were over at the pyramid. It started to pull itself up, slithering its 18-ton mass entirely out of the sand tomb where it had slept. It must be silent, the thing thought. It must sneak up on the creatures, keep them trapped against the wall of the great structure of the old ones. Then it could devour them, suck them dry, one by one.
Rock! Look out!
The creature eyed them with burning red eyes as large as basketballs. Its razor-toothed jaws opened wide enough to swallow a buffalo. Thick saliva pouring down into the swirling sands. It was dark pink, scaled from the neck on down, with foot-thick red bands circling its body every 5 feet. Much of the creature still lay submerged in the sands, but from the size of the head and the car-sized claws that it flopped on each side to keep steady, Rock guessed the thing was a good 100 feet long, and it didn't look to be any too friendly. Archer reached behind him for his crossbow and swung it around, pulling out one of the two remaining arrows from his aluminum quiver. Then it slammed down into the sand, disappearing within seconds beneath the surface, sending out clouds of dust in all directions from the explosive blast of its descent.
Archer, kill!
Great shot, Mountain Man, but I'm afraid it won't be as easy as...
Suddenly, it reappeared some 50 yards out and came tearing at them, moving at lightning speed. It bore down on Chen, its steam shovel jaws open wide. The Chinese-American stared at the vision from hell, his body paralyzed. The free fighter glanced over at Roxon for a split second, as if to say goodbye, then forward again to see his scaly fate bearing down on him. But the thing had not finished having its fun. It veered to the side at the last second, slapping Chen with one of its 5 foot wide claws. Chen landed, dazed, just yards from Roxon.
Should we run for it?
Everyone walk slowly, steadily toward the pyramid. Try to get up on the rocks, maybe it can't climb.
The hell monster surfaced again about 100 yards away, and again lifted its long, almost graceful neck. The multiple red eyes in its head burned with thirst. It came at them. The Doomsday Warrior could see the murderous, primitive hunger in them. The curved teeth glistened from the thin rays of the diffused sun, trying to burn through the pinkish-gray cloud cover. Rock quickly searched the unconscious Chen.
Come on, come on! Tell me you brought... Yes! A Star Knife!
The Doomsday Warrior waited and waited until the thing was just yards away, until he was able to see straight down the dark throat of the unearthly killer. The explosion had severed the massive beast's spinal cord.
Great throw, Rock. I don't know if I could have made that.
I think it was more luck than anything.
They composed themselves, found most of their weapons, and looked over at their monster-killing leader. Roxon went back over to the wall of the pyramid. He just felt around the smooth bronze-like door and found an indentation. It was dark inside, very dark. Rock started to enter.
You're welcome to join me, friends.
Wait, shouldn't we put a guard on the saucer?
Why bother? Nobody's here who could fly the thing. So if Rock dies, we die. It won't matter if the saucer is still in one piece.